Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited.
Hey everyone, welcome to Education Suspended. Also, welcome to December. I hope you're doing well. Hopefully December did not sneak up on you like it did me. I also want to give a big shout out. I know I talk every once in a while about Gina Hansen, who is the teacher that runs our high school internship program, but she's been working overtime as we continue to navigate this amazing program. So thank you, Gina, for all that you do. Also, Keba, thanks for all that you did this trimester. You were awesome. And I hope everybody that's listening takes a moment to listen to our last reflective dissociation session, because Keba joined us. And it was just an honor to have a student share their thoughts and also to have a student be part of this team, which we're going to keep doing, but we're going to have another one join us. So I just wanted to make sure I openly thank Keba for all that he did in the last couple episodes that he edited. So let's jump into today's interview. So we connect with Joel Pippis, who is the project lead for a program called Push to Heal. I heard about this program a couple years ago and have found it very fascinating. And so I'm so glad that we finally got Joel on our podcast. Push to Heal uses skateboarding as a component of treatment for students with high needs. But Joel also talks about how skateboarding can be a therapeutic value and be a strong component of education, and just the overall positive mental health strategy that skateboarding can provide. And yes, I am saying skateboarding because I think, you know, it's an outside the box strategy, which, you know, we love here at Education Suspended. So Joel shares with us about his program, how it came to be. He talks about all the benefits from a sensory experience perspective, from a relational experience perspective. And then one that we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast is also the benefits and how it can help build some executive functioning skills. Joel's got an amazing story himself as a student, and it's really beautiful to see how he's come full circle and how he uses and builds environments around students that also promoted the type of learning that he really enjoyed and thrived in. So Joel, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you all enjoy this episode as much as I did. It was wonderful connecting with him. Sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Joel Pippis.
Have a good day at school. Stay kind and curious.
Oh, there he is.
Hey.
Hey. I love the hat and everything. Oh, I'm a little jealous of the coffee, though. Where is it from? Of course, he would
it's
have
gotta to be, right?
Joel would have to advertise Tim Hortons because he's a good Canadian.
Yeah, it's in my Canadian job description for sure.
We're honored that you are giving us your time. I've been following you and your program for a while and just think it's super cool. So thank you.
It's not really how I think about it. I'm flattered to be invited to be on. And
Grainer, any other Canadian jokes you need to get out?
Oh, I'll just bring my Canadian. I'll just talk Canadian while I get a chance with Joel. So,
well, we got all our Canada stuff out of the way, so I suppose we should get to the interview. Mm-hmm. I know. Sorry, Grainer. Focus. Anyway, Joel, just a little bit about how we start our episodes, and then I'll just hand it directly off to you. So I'm going to have you introduce yourself to our listeners. I'm going to have you talk about what you do, how you got there, and then wrap all that up with, if you feel comfortable, we'd love for you to reflect on your own educational experience as a student and sure. The connections that it has to the now. What's the relationship between your past experience and how you're changing the world?
Sounds good. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm flattered to be asked to be a part of this for sure. My name is Joel, Joel Pippis. I work for an organization in Calgary, Alberta, Canada called Hull Services, which works with children, youth, and families who've experienced significant challenges and really offers them an opportunity to seek well-being and happiness with a focus on mental health. I started it here in 2010, and currently my role is the project lead for a project called Push to Heal, which uses skateboarding through the lens of the neurosequential model, which is the work of Dr. Bruce Perry and the Neurosequential Network, uses skateboarding as an alternative treatment for high needs kids, basically. That's half time. And the other half of my role is a training and education facilitator with my program within Hull, which is called Pathways to Prevention, a Center for Childhood Trauma. Pathways is really focused on imagining a future free from developmental trauma, where families are empowered to meet developmental needs of kids in their community, and focuses on really four pillars of practice, which are education and training, clinical intervention and consultation, research and advocacy. So I'm kind of tucked in under that program using skateboarding as one way, but also focused on a couple other therapeutic recreation-based projects and helping to practically implement some of these neuroscience and developmentally informed concepts into the practical on-the-floor work that our staff do. My experience in school is probably a bit unique, I guess. I was actually homeschooled up until junior high school, and then I went to public school for junior high and high school. I actually have a religious studies degree that it took me a very long time to complete. Twice I left long enough that my courses were going to expire if I didn't return that semester. Because in all honesty, I don't like school. I am someone who struggles to sit still and focus. And I learn best by seeing and doing rather than hearing. And so generally, the education system isn't super well designed for people like me. But interestingly, when I look back at the things that my mom did when she was teaching me at home, I probably did school for 2 or 3 hours a day, and I was a couple grades ahead by the time I got to junior high school. And then my grades kind of slowly declined until I graduated. But she would do stuff like, okay, Joel, we're going to do, you know, math minutes or math review. And I would put on rollerblades and rollerblade back and forth across the kitchen while she quizzed me. Or she would say, do 15 minutes on this project, then you can go for a loop around the block on your bike or whatever it would be. Go play basketball in the backyard for 15 minutes, come back and do. So I had all of these doses of what I now understand to be things that helped calm and regulate me that I was not allowed to or able to access when I went into public school.
I just want to clarify a little bit. So you're saying you were for all sakes and purposes, above grade level academically, and then your grades started declining, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah, it was probably different subject to subject. But for example, I got to grade 7 and I would ask about, we'd do a math concept that I already knew. And I would say, well, this is what I was learning. And they would say, oh, that doesn't happen for a couple more years or things like that. So I think generally I was above my peers. And then for the most part, my grades just kind of slowly declined until I graduated high school. The more independently I needed to sit and work on things, the more challenges I had, for sure.
I'm really curious about your mother. You mentioned a couple regulating things she let you do. What were maybe some of the outdoor regulating things you got to do because she had this vision of this way to educate?
I mean, there was stuff that she did a good job building in, like tactile things, you know, using cubes and things like that to do math so they could be visual and tactile as well. When I was going outside, my family was really sports focused. And so we had a basketball hoop in the backyard and a place I could shoot pucks and bikes to ride and all of these sorts of things. You know, she would get calls when we were kids from the neighbors saying, do you know your kids are on the roof of the garage? And she would say, yeah. And they would say, what are you going to do? And she'd say, they'll probably jump down when they're done and then come inside. So I think it was really kind of, you know, the need for movement and the focus on play was emphasized. And yeah, I look back on that as something that I now understand to have been super helpful for me.
Yeah, I've only studied the Finnish model of education enough to be dangerous, but doesn't it sound like it, Jessica? I think Joel's in the Finnish model with his mother, where there's 15 minutes of movement every hour and most everything's outside, and they do probably not care if you're climbing on the roof, unless it's the school roof. So
it's interesting when we think about your program that you are the leader of and Push to Heal, right? I think the descriptions of play, of sensory integration, and probably even a relational component all exist in this program. So can you talk us through, how is this formed? What are the underpinnings that you see being successful for students as it pertains to skateboarding?
So I was working at Hull in one of our therapeutic campus-based care programs where the kids live. And about 5 or 6 years in, we're lucky enough that the programs are on this 28-acre campus in the south of Calgary. And that campus had an old hockey rink. And I came back from a vacation and someone had said to me, they started building a skate park on the old rink. And I thought they were messing with me. Not-for-profits don't spend money on skateboarding. Nobody does, in fact. And drove over there afterwards, saw that a park was being built, which the Matt Bannister Memorial Skate Park, built as a memorial to a young man who passed away from an overdose, but who family felt skateboarding had been a healthy thing in his life. So they linked up with a really great skate park building company called New Line Skate Parks and their community and built this park on our campus as a memorial. So I started knocking on doors to see how I could be involved. I kind of took on the rollout of the park for our organization. And honestly, I started convincing kids to go to the park because I had keys to a private skate park. And that was a childhood dream. And I thought getting out and moving would be helpful, but it's honestly all that I thought about it. And what we found was, or observed, I should say, is as soon as we started taking kids to the park, it became clear that there was this connection between more time spent at the park and progress in their treatment goals. Normally, it's more likely for a young person to go into crisis coming out of a preferred activity because they are stopping something that they want to do. But in this case, the crisis was more likely to happen before, which to me pointed to something about this being regulating. For whatever reason, that environment and that activity was leading kids who were kind of mortal enemies to the program to build friendships around this activity and in this environment. And so I started asking questions of folks within the organization, like, can you help me understand what I'm observing here? Eventually landed in Dr. Emily Wong's office. And we just started talking about the lens that neuroscience and developmentally informed lens provides. Skateboarding is an activity that is a full brain activity. So if they're engaging in it and they want to be there, and there's at least one safe person around, it's a sensory rich, pattern and repetitive, so organically regulating activity. From a relational and attachment perspective, for a lot of the folks we serve, traditional sports, as much as I love them and grew up being involved, don't fit very well because, you know, maybe social cues can't be read fast enough at the pace of the game, or the rules are too structured or not structured enough. And so for a lot of the population that we serve, sport, which is supposed to be this thing that combats marginalization, actually was kind of further marginalizing. But in the context of something like skateboarding, which, you know, it's in the Olympics now, but in general, it's an individual sport that you do in the context of individual activity that you do in the context of a community. So there's a lot of relational control. It's even built around doing things in parallel. You're not, you know, standing face to face, which is a bit more intense. You're both leaning against the fence, looking at the park, talking about the trick that you're going to try. And there's enough control that you could honestly decide that the conversation you're having with me is too much or too annoying and roll away. And that's a totally socially appropriate thing to do in that environment, which is not the case in most social environments. If you just leave mid-sentence, people look at you funny. Lastly, the whole thing is kind of based around those executive functions and learning new skills, which I think maybe to kind of put a pin on the whole thing, a lot of our kids don't spend a lot of time because of their trauma background and history of marginalization in that cortex and accessing those executive functions. But if they're in an activity that is regulating them while they participate, they have a better opportunity to spend more time there. So yeah, that was kind of the foundation of how we started thinking about skateboarding as maybe this thing that could have some value therapeutically.
I want to parse apart a lot of the stuff that you said there, because I think there was a lot of things that we can dive into. But before we do that, I am curious. As I was preparing for this, you know, one of the things that came up is, and I don't know how to say this in a way that maybe doesn't sound mean, but sometimes there's a stereotype of what you anticipate a skateboarder is going to be. And oftentimes when there is that stereotype, it's more negative, right? Troublemakers, substance abuse, right? And so I'm wondering, is that something that you've experienced? And did it impact kind of your ability to roll this out with your students?
Yeah, for sure that stereotype exists, although I think it's changing a little more recently. And for sure I ran into it. But interestingly, I think a lot of the time when you work with a higher needs population, there's more of an understanding of the need to think outside the box and consider alternative approaches. So in terms of internally within the organization or speaking to people in the field, I didn't rub up against the stigma or the preconceptions there. I think where we've run up against it more often is in systems. So for example, we have a couple of school partnerships as a part of our continuum of services. And the one on our campus that I worked at for a number of years is the only school in the Calgary Board of Education that's allowed to use skateboarding as a part of educational hours. Otherwise, it's a prohibited activity across all other settings in the board. And so I had to meet with the head of corporate risk management and make a pitch for why I thought it should be allowed at Hull School for that to be the case. And the only rational explanation I can find for that is stigma. It's not more dangerous than the traditional sports. So definitely you do rub up against it. But I would also say that in kind of a funny way, it's been helpful for the message of the project because skateboarding is not something that people are thinking about as therapeutic. And so when you have that conversation, I think it sticks with people a bit. And they're like, really? Skateboarding is helpful. Skateboarding could help to heal the brain. Really? And in that way, it's maybe just accepted enough that you can move forward from there, but thought negatively enough that it seems a real novel concept and people want to talk more about it.
My grandson skateboards and I've taken him to the skateboard park. And what I noticed interestingly that I think he was about 10 at the time and everyone else there was 30 or 40. There weren't a lot of layers of ages at the skateboard park. And so some of those stereotypes existed with the older fellas, although they were wonderful, but my grandson was kind of alone. Take us through a process of getting new kids or kids who've never skateboarded, who aren't just natural, you know, part of the culture because they loved it and were already into it before you met them. How do you introduce it and get kids sold to this activity?
You know, interestingly, I would say it's an education podcast. So to come back to that, one of the ways that was done effectively is we went through this process of developing an intervention, a curriculum that we're working on. It's like a learn to skateboard for your brain. So the idea is you learn to skateboard and you have that foundation of concepts, of trauma-informed concepts and neuroscience and developmentally informed concepts that we were talking about earlier, mixed in with a hope that with that understanding and using skateboarding to illustrate the concepts that hopefully skateboarding can become a tool for positive mental health that can be used proactively and reactively for those students. Because a lot of the stuff we do is hard to generalize to less intensive, less specialized settings. But skateboarding is a really adaptive pro-social thing that they, you know, a kid that's in a fight with their parents at home could have as a plan. My skateboard's by the door, I go roll around for 15 minutes and I come back and we try that conversation that was tricky again. And what we did was work with some classrooms at the school and use their psychoeducational blocks and said, what if I came and taught these blocks, six of them together and they're double blocks. And so we would do that. And the buy-in, to come back to your point, Steve, was they're at school and they get to go to the skate park. So if they could be sitting in the classroom and doing just about anything else or going to the skate park, they would choose going to the skate park, even if they, and I think a big part of that is because they got to get up and move. It was novel. It was unique. We were using, you know, multimedia to help get the teaching across, all of that kind of stuff. And I mean, of course, it's also kids that there are relationships with and all of that stuff that certainly helps or is foundational to getting good engagement. But that's kind of the main way, I think, is there's the relational engagement. Skateboarding is, I don't know if you can call it a cool factor, but is interesting enough to most people that they want to know more. And they got to do it during school hours instead of insert any other thing that you have to do at school.
I was teasing you. I grew up on a skateboard. That was a 2x6 with roller skates hammered into it. That's, and you know, just go down a hill as dangerous as you can and jump into the grass. Kind of, that was my kind of way. But you know,
the wheel is steel or ceramic.
Yeah. Steel. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It was still cool. We thought, now I'm thinking in your case, how hard is it to take a kid who's never skateboarded, but does want to get out of class? Sort of the stair step to different layers or different skill levels that can still be part of the community. Maybe I'm going that direction.
So the classrooms are smaller groups and that's part of it. And maybe this is a good foundation. So at Hull School, every class, it's a partnership between the Calgary Board of Education and Hall Services, and every classroom has a Calgary Board of Education teacher and at least two Hall child and youth care counselors, usually for about 8 to 10 students, sometimes more counselors depending on the needs of the young people that are in there. And so me coming and doing that adds a whole other body and a whole other staff person. And there's really great resources and information, especially coming out of the social skate projects around the world. Organizations like Skatistan and Good Push and Skate Like a Girl and all of these organizations. And so they have games that are engaging and help with education. They have activities. They have systems of teaching skills. And a lot of the games and activities are really great because you can engage fully with them at a whole variety of skill levels. It just looks a bit different. And when we need to separate, we just broke into a little bit smaller groups and did that. So I think because of our ratios, which is a blessing that we have, we could really meet people where they were at. And that also allowed us to accelerate the comfort level and education around skateboarding to get the group kind of closer together.
You know, thank you for acknowledging, right? Like in public school settings, like that's just not the reality in public schools. And I respect that, but I also do want to highlight even for those who are in public schools, right? Like, can we talk about the avenues and the ways to use skateboarding? Because again, you highlighted the relational component, you highlighted the sensory integration component. And I think most importantly, especially as it pertains to education and where we see kids struggle, is the executive functioning piece. Even today, I met with the family of a student and I found myself recommending Taekwondo, martial arts, right? Like kind of these sensory pieces that also encourage mindfulness. Not that I know anything about skateboarding, but what comes to me is that there has to be some level of mindfulness in skateboarding because your ass doesn't want to fall off that skateboard. Like you have to be kind of present.
Yeah, for sure.
So can you talk about a little bit more of the executive functioning piece and how that is integrated with everything? And then, sorry, this is a very long-winded question. This happens. And then jump into, for those in public school, what could this look like?
Yeah, I would say the big learning that I had with skateboarding and the executive functioning piece was actually a kid on a BMX bike that I used to work with. And so he and I went from the program and would spend time at the skate park together. We got there one day and he said to me, you know, Joel, I want to jump down those stairs. And I said, great. And the way that the park is set up, that meant he needed to learn to drop in on his bike, which he hadn't done before, on a quarter pipe, carry his speed over this spine, which he didn't know how to do, hop the bike, bunny hop, and then land and roll away. So I kind of skated the park fairly independently for about 15 or 20 minutes. And eventually he came riding up to me with a ear-to-ear grin on his face saying, did you see that? And he had jumped down the stairs. And he was a kid that was developmentally very low and a really significant trauma history. And he wasn't supposed to be able to do complex problem solving. But what he had done, as I reflected on it, was take a complex problem, break it into 4 steps, practice those steps individually, and put it all together to get where he wanted to be. And so I think if we're willing to do the legwork and adjust our language and be creative, activities like skateboarding, and it certainly isn't the only one, can become a template that we can use in the other areas of the kid's life and say, okay, well, think about it like that thing at the skate park. You know, what were the steps? How do you practice them individually? And again, to highlight, a lot of the kids can't access those executive functions because they're dysregulated so much, often in a very tame way relative to the kids that I work with. I think about my own experiences sitting there with my legs shaking in class or trying to draw just to sustain my attention. And that's very low level in terms of the challenges of education, right? So that teaching sort of happening, moving and on the fly meant that the student was being regulated while he was learning and being able to stay in the smart part of his brain that where he could access those executive functions. And from a perspective of the typical ratios in education, I think there are really significant pros and cons to being in a setting like ours to building in this kind of thing. So obviously we're very privileged to have the ratios that we have the training that we have, the support that we have. But those are also for very, very complex learners and very, very high needs kids. And a lot of those ratios are even just safety based on the kids' needs. But what I would argue is that if this kind of stuff works to engage our population, it would work to engage most learners. And absolutely, it's different for someone external with the time and energy to come into a classroom and say, could I do psychoed for you? But most teachers are not getting somebody like that offering to take some of their teaching time. But that's one of the reasons why we're trying to develop a curriculum, is if it's pre-made and it can be implemented by somebody in a traditional school setting, then my belief is the fact that it's an activity that I think and a culture that I think the kids would be interested in learning more about and engaging with. The fact that we do a lot of illustrating of the concepts, because skateboarding is a culture where photography and videography and art are embedded in everything, which means that if you want to get a beautifully produced movie about any topic, you just go on YouTube and you'll find it under skateboarding, which is also really engaging. And a focus in education is building in that multimedia component and the tech savvy that's required these days. And a big part of, you know, maybe I'm going a little bit off track on your question, but I think it's worth mentioning because it's something that I have been thinking a lot about lately. If you're a teacher who hates skateboarding, don't use skateboarding, or has no interest in skateboarding with the kids, do not use skateboarding. But if it's an area of passion, wouldn't it be wonderful to get to build one of your passions into your work? And wouldn't the students get such a better version of you because you're excited and passionate about, I mean, everyone's favorite teacher was excited and passionate about what they were teaching. And I think of myself in the context that I've worked in here, the kids get the best version of me probably at the skate park because I'm less stressed out and more regulated and more excited and passionate. And I can't, and every day I can't believe it's part of my job. That's really easy to say. And you're supposed to create the space and the curriculum out of nowhere, obviously. But our goal is to be developing a curriculum that can be integrated in traditional systems. And I think it's worth paying attention to finding a way to build your passions in to treatment and education, because the impact is massive.
Okay. I love Jessica's question about executive function, but I want to go to the bottom part of the understanding of the brain and its development and the way it operates, because to generalize for our educators on this podcast, how important it is to have an understanding of the sensory regulation part of any activity. Doesn't have to be skateboarding, but you're seeing it, and you're seeing that the flow, it's a flow activity. It includes everything, but it really does start with those sensory things. And especially, I would guess, proprioception for those people who like that word, or just knowing where your body is in space, kind of balance and all that. Can you just talk all about why the sensory part matters so much? And I think we're missing it in typical schools often, that is a key to healing and to learning and relating. So
I think for skateboarding specifically, you know, if you think about being in an educational setting, and I'm not sure what the terminology would be in the States or in other places around the world, but here in Calgary, if a kid comes in with an IPP, an individualized program plan, and a psychoeducational assessment, I think a lot of teachers, administrators, everybody already knows they're in for it a little bit. This is going to be a complex learner. And there are really great resources that and recommendations that typically come with those assessments. But I'm personally really passionate about and interested in the day-to-day, as we go, way of meeting those needs. So skateboarding is very sensory rich. A lot of skateboarders, you could tell them to close their eyes and you could put on a skate film and they could tell you the tricks that are happening based on just the pitch of the wheel squeaking, or if there's a scrape that goes along with the pop, or whatever it might be. Even pushing down a sidewalk gives you patterned and repetitive stimulus. So there's those cracks in the sidewalk and the wheels go click, 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 click. It's like, it's fully is like a heartbeat. And if it's a young person who needs to lower stimulus, there's also the opportunity to do it independently out in the open air, really just focused on sound or, you know, feeling or whatever else. And then to build up just slightly from that lower brain stuff, the whole activity, like we just talked about, the stimulus of the sound on the sidewalk, pushing, pumping around a park, back and forth in a half pipe, it's all patterned and repetitive. which we know is generally a regulating thing for human beings. The reality is that the more students and anybody are engaged in activities that meet their sensory needs and are regulating, the better their ability to connect relationally and learn new skills. So from my perspective, anytime I'm trying to teach a child a new skill or anyone anything, it's in my best interest to be looking at their regulation first, whether or not they're feeling safe and connected relationally. Otherwise, whatever we're trying to teach is more likely to be frustrating for the learner and the educator. So I think that's been an area of focus for us. We also have this greenhouse garden farm that's attached to the school on our campus here. And in very similar way, parallels getting kids out with their hands in the dirt, going through the process of planting or harvesting, which is very sensory rich, pattern repetitive. There's not a lot of tasting happening at the skate park, but there's lots of tasting happening in the garden, working in parallel with another staff. And then with both of those projects, capitalizing on the passion and excitement that the kids who are showing it are showing for those things, and looking for cross-curricular benefits, looking for opportunities to take the traditional subjects and build them in. For example, skateboarding is primarily physics. You can do lots of math stuff. You can do lots of art and social studies with it, all of these kind of things. And for sure, that takes extra legwork and preparation on the side of the educator. But I have also found that once you get going, the students start to takes on a bit of a life of its own, because there's this excitement between teacher and student, or there can be, about where we're going with this thing.
Okay, I'm so glad that you just talked about the educational piece, because I was also mulling that over. Are there activities that teachers can actually do from the academic perspective? And math came up for me, science came up for me. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. It's hard, because I want to stick with this push to heel skateboarding piece, but you have, no pun intended, dropped the carrot in about your farm. And Steve and I both love talking with schools and programs that utilize farming and cultivation. And you were just comparing the two. Can you share a little bit more about this farm and the way that the students utilize it on your campus?
Yeah, totally. So Push to Heal started for about 5 or 6 years, really as a passion project. I couldn't believe I got to make skateboarding a part of my work. But the majority of it, with lots of support from people around the agency, was on my own time trying to build it. And similarly, with the greenhouse and garden, a guy named Vaden Summers has really advocated for and built up. It started with a greenhouse, and then there was a couple garden plots that were added, and this big 50-foot long caterpillar tunnel. And now currently there is a deck being installed with an outdoor kitchen on the greenhouse, and a pond with a waterfall and a dock that goes out from the deck. And we designed it with the concept in mind of the population that we serve, getting them out, to your point, Steve, that foundation of the sensory integration and the regulation stuff. Like, the kids could sit on the dock and put their feet in the pond and then have the tough conversation that they need to have. And there's also a food forest that was just put in. So the students learn about planting. They start from seed in the grow tent in the shop. It moves as it gets healthier into the greenhouse and then the caterpillar tunnel and out into the main plot. They're involved in varying degrees at all levels of the preparation and development. And they go home for the summer, and basically harvest starts as the kids are returning to school. And so, of course, no pun intended again, is ripe with educational opportunity. The foods classes, the kids are growing the food that they're using to cook. There's, of course, science. There's, of course, math. There's all of these sorts of things. And for the population that we serve, there's also opportunity for work experience roles. And some students even can get a job working in the greenhouse and garden over the summer to prepare them for the workforce. They're learning a trade. There's all of these sorts of things, right? And so it helps to have people that can help bridge the gap to how these things can be used academically. But the opportunity is huge, I would say.
I'm just kind of reiterating a point, because I had written it down before Joel said it. I wrote, uniquely Joel, your own regulation. I thought, how beautiful that you were able to find something that was uniquely you It also provides your own regulation, which I think more of our teachers would love to hear about and think about. But passion projects, kind of finding your own soul as a teacher and using it in your classroom to do exactly what you said. I think we don't emphasize it enough. Too many little boxes on the hillside rather than teachers finding their unique vision for what they can bring to a classroom that is also regulating for them. It's something I really recognized in you and knowing students like you over many years that just needed something like that. It seems like there'd be many opportunities for teachers to be who they are and provide the same sort of regulation.
Vaden and I have talked a lot about, and he actually made a comment at some point, because the projects mirror each other, we work very closely. And he made a comment that these projects might have a bigger benefit for the staff than they do for the kids. And of course, we think there's a benefit for the kids, but you know, we had casual staff that are asking to come in on certain days so they can be a part of the skate program, that are starting skateboarding outside of it, and exactly the same way that have gone on and gotten permaculture certifications because of their involvement. And every time they get a bit more interested and a bit more passionate, they find ways to free up another hour a week, another 5 hours a week, that they can support the vision of what's happening in that greenhouse and garden. And the most successful classroom experiences have been led by a passionate teacher. We had one of the classrooms that we did the pilot project of the curriculum that we were doing the research around. That teacher was so invested in the idea of building skateboarding into the work that you do that she would come to me weekly and say, "We're doing science. What can we do for skateboarding?" And she would put in the extra legwork. So she said, "The unit we're doing is forces and structure," I think it was called. And so there is this culture inside skateboarding, this DIY culture of working with concrete and making your own spots. So a few of the students that were interested and able built a concrete form with me and learned to pour concrete, and we made a parking block. And then we turned that into an art project. So they painted it and personalized it. And then we all took that new feature over to the skate park together and used it as a part of our skate classes. And so that's math, science, art, all of that kind of stuff built in. And that classroom, it was just this sort of perfect spot of passion between kids and students, students and staff, and everybody being excited that skate class was coming, or like they were all having a growing interest in this culture. And you won't always hit that much of a sweet spot, but it's possible for sure. And I don't know if it's possible in the same way without those passion projects.
What's connecting for me, and you probably are aware of this, Joel, but you know, it's so interesting that during your homeschool experience, you had an educator that really prioritized play, that really prioritized the authentic self and the power of that in the academic environment. And here you are, just a few years later, prioritizing your play and your authentic self, and you're experiencing firsthand the benefits, again, in the educational setting. So I don't find it a coincidence that you're doing such a good job at that. Is there... And I might have missed this, but is there a mentor component to your program, right? Like, do you have students that are with you for a while and they can begin to mentor younger or less experienced skateboarders?
It's something that we're working on building in and that we've had off and on. So, you know, programming is a component of Push to Heal. And another sort of very main component of it is less about programming and more about trying to develop the lens of how skateboarding can be used as a resource to share with our partners around the world. So because the programming has ebbs and flows, part of it is the weather in Calgary. They look out to a lot of snow out my office window. And part of it is also the nature of the population that we serve, how rapidly they are coming in and out of services at times, and how usually if you have someone over a long period of time, it's because of how exceptional the needs are. And so it's kind of hard to find the sweet spot where the mentoring capacity is built in. But we've had a few situations where we've been able to sort of graduate folks in the program to become mentors, and it was awesome. So that's something that I would like to do more. That's a focus for us for sure. But the times when we've been able to do it, it's been really, really great.
I love the potential for expansion. But when I was just reading about you and watching the video and all of that, I was really intrigued by Skatistan. I thought, yeah, people should hear about this because it's not just in Calgary, it's like in Afghanistan. So just a minute or two to tell us a little bit about that connection and that relationship.
Yeah, so Skatistan started in Afghanistan. It's unfortunately not there anymore since the Taliban took over. They focus primarily on education and empowerment of equity deserving groups. So in particular, women in Afghanistan and other folks who have needs that make equity in activities like that a challenge. So obviously they were not thought of very well by the Taliban, because that's kind of the opposite of a lot of what was happening. They're still in South Africa, Cambodia, and Jordan. From my perspective anyways, they're kind of the industry standard worldwide for social skate work. And they've started a wing of their organization called Good Push, which is building the international social skate community and trying to really sort of up the quality of the work all of us are doing. So they do surveys every year to gather what's happening around the world. They host speakers, and if somebody builds a child protection policy, they share that with all of the organizations, that kind of stuff. And our connection to them is that when we kind of stumbled into this connection between skateboarding and the treatment that was going on, I knew of Skatistan and had reached out to them and basically just said, you're doing this incredible work using skateboarding as a bridge to education for really high needs kids around the world. This fit is so perfect. You must know about it. That's why it works so well. And their response was, we all thought there was something, but nobody had connected it to a model or a system of thinking yet. So could I call into their strategic planning meetings for the year? Could we talk more about it? And that was in, I think, 2016, maybe. And so we've been trying to collaborate since then. They and so many other social skate organizations around the world do phenomenal work. And part of our mission is just to hopefully provide some tools that can help support the work that they're doing.
All right, Joel, unfortunately, we do have to let you go. Thank you for joining us. I didn't even say, I think my life is going to involve skateboarding, because my daughter, she's 4. And when she was about maybe 20 months, she hopped on a scooter for the first time. And I mean, Grainer has seen the videos, and I actually sent him to Dr. Perry quite a bit too. She's good. She's really good on a scooter. And about the age of 2.5, she started riding the scooter like a skateboard and just holding her hands. So I was like, oh Lord above, what am I getting into? So I was glad. Yeah. Good Lord. Anyway, It meant a lot to have you on this podcast. Thank you for doing the good work. I also, obviously, a big shout out to Emily Wong. She is, I mean, just a phenomenal leader, right? And just kind of, you said, the ability to think outside the box, the ability to take risks. I mean, she understood and connected the dots. So I think that, just wanted to make sure we give her a shout out as well.
Yeah, she's amazing and has been a huge support an advocate for all of this since the beginning, and is the one leading pathways to prevention as well.
Yeah. She's been on our radar to get on this podcast for 4 seasons now. So Emily will hear this, and we're coming for you. We promise we'll get you on.
We got to say one last thing. To see Emily and Joel together on their documentary, it's easy to access. That's a quick Google, Push to Heal, Joel Pippas, and you got it. And it's 15 minutes. That's really rich for any educator to see. This is what happens when someone takes their passion and turns it into a project that affects so many kids.
Yeah, good connection. All right, Joel, thank you. Hopefully our paths will cross again. And thank you for doing the good work and changing the system.
Thanks for having me.